This is The Storyline, produced by The Day in New London, Connecticut. I'm Peter Huapi. On this week's episode, a federal court rules in favor of Connecticut's third casino development, and millions of dollars of automobiles up for auction at Mohegan Sun. The Mohegan and Mashantucket Pequot tribes are working in partnership to develop a third casino in East Windsor, Connecticut. A federal appeals court recently upheld an earlier dismissal of a lawsuit filed by MGM Resorts International, claiming that the Connecticut law that allowed the tribe's joint venture was unconstitutional. The Day's Brian Hollenbeck has been covering this lawsuit. Brian, MGM is developing a casino in Springfield, Mass., and they would obviously prefer not to have competition just 15 miles away. Let's start by going back to the original law passed in 2015. What was that law that allowed the tribes to partner on this effort?
Okay. That law authorized the two tribes to form a joint venture. Now, of course, these two tribes have been operating Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun for 20 and 25 years, and fierce competitors all that time, so it was kind of unusual. They had to come together to agree to pursue this third casino. But this law back in 2015 only authorized them to form their joint venture and then to seek site proposals. It didn't actually authorize a casino. That was made part of a second legislative approach, which has since come to pass. But back in 2015, that's all they were authorized to do. And that's what prompted this lawsuit by MGM.
So MGM's lawsuit challenges the 2015 law. What's their legal argument?
They argued that that the law was unconstitutional and that it specifically it violated the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, also the Commerce Clause. And I guess a way to describe them is sort of think of as antitrust. It gave them, they argued that it gave these two tribes the exclusive right to pursue this project and to ultimately pursue commercial gaming in the state of Connecticut, which is prohibited. So, you know, they argued that it was unfair. They put them at an unfair disadvantage. They claimed that they had some interest of their own in eventually developing a Connecticut casino, although, and this became central to the judge's decision, although they never filed any specific plan to do so.
Connecticut gets a lot of revenue from the tribes, and there's some worry about that revenue decreasing with the development of competing casinos. And this was a huge issue during the election last year. It was something everybody was talking about. What were the big arguments for and against this third casino?
Well, absolutely. The tribes contribute most recently about $260 million in the most recent fiscal year to Connecticut's coffers by paying 25% of their slot machine revenues at Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun. And that's a total that has declined somewhat precipitously since its peak in fiscal 2007, I believe it was, 2007 or 2008. That contribution totaled about $430 million then. So now we're down to 260, and the prospect of growing competition out of state is going to put further pressure on that number. It's projected to go down below $200 million, possibly by 2019 and beyond. MGM is building a $950 million resort casino in Springfield, Mass. I think, as you mentioned, only 15 miles from East Windsor. So, you know, their revenue projections are based on them not having competition that close, 15 miles away. And so that certainly is behind how vociferously they've been fighting this legislation in Connecticut and their attempt to prevent a third casino here. They've done some investigations of their own, some marketing studies and so on, and they said that that they have some interest in developing a Connecticut casino at some point, and they identified southwestern Connecticut as the best place to put that. So now during the last legislative session and even before that, actually as part of their suit as well, they've made this argument that it's unfair to give the two tribes the exclusive right to pursue another, a commercial casino in Connecticut. And so they were behind an alternative bill, which would have created an open bidding process. Now, they touted that by saying, by going that route, the state probably could have raised a lot more money. They could have charged licensing fees. They could have charged application fees. They could have, you know, generated hundreds of millions of dollars, possibly in upfront money, as other states have done that have pursued commercial gaming. Good example is Massachusetts, where I believe casinos were required to pay an $85 million licensing fee up front, even before they were approved. And then, of course, then they would have to agree also to pay a percentage of their gaming revenues once they were operational. But that's a lot different than the tribes here face. And some people have even said up in, even until right now, that even before the governor signs this bill, that maybe it should be tweaked to require the tribes to pay a licensing fee or some kind of upfront amount before it can pursue the East Windsor deal. But I think that's kind of a dead issue because it's not in the bill that was approved by legislators and or in the and in the bill that is now on the governor's desk.
So does this ruling then clear the way for the casino in East Windsor to proceed, or are there other hurdles that the tribes are facing?
It'll require a an amendment in the tribe's current agreements with the state to reflect that they're now operating another casino, even though it's a commercial one. But as I understand it, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the federal agency that regulates tribes, will have to sign off on it. So that's a kind of a, they certainly presented as kind of a just a clerical thing that needs to happen, and it could take several weeks, if not months. Covered the tribes just this morning. They appeared before the Chamber of Commerce meeting this morning in town, and Chairman Butler of the Mashantucket said that that process could take 6 months, and then once they start construction, they think they can get this thing open within 18 months thereafter. So if we're taking it from right now, let's say from July 1, 2 years before this thing could be open. Now, that assumes that there's no legal problems that could get in the way. MGM, as recently as yesterday, when this most recent court decision came down, said that they will still intend to pursue further litigation over this new law, and that this court decision that came down yesterday would not preclude them from doing so.
So this is an issue that we are going to be hearing about for quite some time to come.
I think so. I think so. I think it's, you know, there's so much at stake here that MGM is not going to give up until they have to, I guess.
It's the Sports Doctor, Keith P. O'Brien. If you want a different take, if you want a different angle, a different way to view sports, well, check out my weekly podcast, and I will show you the way from a fan's standpoint. We'll bring you great guests, local, national, athletes, coaches, players, you name it. I'll bring it to you, Sports Doctor Podcast, right here on theday.com.
Last year, the Barrett-Jackson Northeast Collector Car Auction at Mohegan Sun sold 552 vehicles totaling over $26 million. This year's edition of the auction just kicked off, and Brian Hallenbeck, you were there. Could you describe the scene for us?
Well, it's really kind of wild if you're not familiar with that kind of thing. It's just, it's really impressive just the volume of people that are on the property for this thing. Mohegan Sun derives all kinds of benefit, I think, beyond just the auction itself, because it draws so many people to the property. And I was just walking through the casino, getting to the auction site, which is in the Mohegan Sun Arena, yesterday, and I was just impressed with just the number of bodies that were all over the gaming floors. You know, it probably is reminiscent of the heyday there, and that which we don't see, particularly on a midweek at this point. You wouldn't expect to see that many people filling up the place. So it was very busy. In the arena itself, if you have never seen an auction, it's really a sight. Place is pretty well packed, and there's just this nonstop patter. It was the word I used in today's story. I don't know if that's the best word, but to describe the auctioneer's spiel, which is ongoing constantly, and as the vehicles move across this auction block, and almost all of them driven. I mean, they're completely operational, and they got drivers in them and people pushing them as well, and they come up on this block and they move across it as you're facing it from left to right. And I would say, you know, when it's one after another, and I would say a vehicle might be on that block for no more than 2 minutes. I was trying to time them yesterday, and from the time they come up it to the time that they roll off it, they're sold. And they were going for in the $10,000-$20,000 range when I was there early in the afternoon. So that was soon after the auction started. And this will continue for the next 2 days, continuing today, Friday and Saturday as well. And my experience from last year was the amounts got higher as the auction went on, until by the last day, Saturday, you have things moving that are in six figures, well into six figures, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it and then the hooting and hollering begins, and it really gets very exciting towards the end. When the numbers get bigger, it gets more intense.
So this is interesting to me. We live in this time where you can buy just about anything online, and this is a very much in-person experience. And does this look and sound like we imagine the traditional auction would?
Absolutely.
The fast-talking auctioneer? Are people raising their hands
to
bid? And
yes, as I was being careful to keep my hands at my side. I didn't want to be mistaken for a bidder. Yeah, very much so. As I said, it's a very exciting atmosphere to it. And I said the auctioneers are amazing. I mean, they're a story in themselves, how they just keep up that staccato, that rapid fire description of the vehicles, and they're calling out. You know, I've got thousand. You know, I've got 10,000 out over here. Do I hear 10,500? Do I hear 11? Blah blah blah. You know, and it goes on like that. They're amazing, and I think they have several of them, so they can substitute them in and out because it's so intense.
Do you get a sense for how many people are there actually to bid, and how many are there just as for the spectator experience?
That's a good question. I would say there are probably hundreds of bidders, and you have to register and certify yourself as such, and they are occupying most of the seats on the floor in front of the auction block. And I would say there's probably several hundred, if not thousands, a couple thousand maybe are registered that'll bid at some point during the 3 days. And then I think, Peter, you mentioned the attendance last year was 90,000 over the 3 days. And so you've got tens of thousands of people that are then filling the other levels of the arena as spectators.
So if you're just a car aficionado, you can go take in the spectacle, see some interesting vehicles.
Absolutely, absolutely. Anything, it's all cars. It's anything cars. In addition to the auction of the cars themselves each day, prior to that, there's an auction of automobilia, which is all kinds of car-related stuff, old gas pumps from gas stations, gas station signage, and stuff like that. And it's pretty brisk bidding goes on that as well, I guess.
So you were at this event this year and last year. What kind of cars did you see being sold? Anything particularly interesting or unique?
Well, it's it kind of runs the gamut. They're all in just fabulous shape. There's a lot of vets, and in fact, there's a lot of Corvettes that are stationed throughout the casino on display. If you don't even have to go into the arena to see them, as you just walk through the concourse in the casino, you can see some of those, and which will eventually be auctioned, I guess. Then there are some what you might call the antiques. I know there was a 1946 Packard, I think, that went yesterday while I was there, and some old things. There are several motorcycles are auctioned, and a couple of tractors. When I was there was this gorgeous Kelly Green John Deere that went yesterday for several thousand and just in pristine condition. A lot of these things have been in collections for a long time and have been on displays in museums and other places, and they come out in parades and so on. So they're in impeccable shape, and in many of them they may be very old, but they have very little mileage on them. You know, they've been in collections for a long time. So everything is really pristine and just really dazzling to look at.
And so this is a partnership going forward now for the Mohegans and Barrett Jackson, and it's driving some more construction at the,
absolutely,
at the casino too, right?
Absolutely. They signed a 5-year deal, so this is the second year of the 5-year deal to host this thing, and it had never been anywhere in the Northeast before, and there aren't many places that where it could be. And after last year's success, Mohegan Sun actually started to contemplate actually developing a place to host this, a convention center. You know, it's in the Mohegan Sun arena now, where Mohegan Sun has all its big entertainment acts, and they have to give up a weekend of entertainment to host this thing. And so I think that was part of their thinking, was if we had a convention center that could accommodate Barrett Jackson, we could have that, and then on that same weekend have a big entertainment act and really blow the place out. So they decided to pursue an $80 million convention center, which is now under construction. And they hope to have it open for next year's Barrett Jackson event. And I think there's also some talk going on already that this could lead to extending the arrangement, you know, well beyond where it is now, and keep Barrett Jackson coming back for the Northeast auction every year for a long time.
And this is all part of a trend at the casinos to sort of diversify beyond just gaming, right?
Absolutely. You know, this is a trend that's been going on in the industry for some time. I think in Las Vegas, for example, I think only 50% of the revenue at the casinos out there, it comes from gaming. Now, we're nowhere near that in southeastern Connecticut yet. I think gaming still makes up 70% to 80% of their revenues, but at both Mohegan Sun and Foxwoods, that's changing. You're going to see some things coming there, kind of interesting. This summer, Foxwoods has got this zip line that they're going to introduce. That's going to go from the top of their casino, one of their casino towers there, down to the Mashantucket Museum, and the people on that line are going to reach speeds of 60 miles an hour and so on. And these are the kinds of things they're looking into. Of course, they opened the Tanger Outlets here a couple years ago, so there's all kinds of retail. Mohegan Sun has really done a great job with the entertainment. You know, their arena, just the size of that, enables them to get acts that that no one else really in the region can get. And it's really been a huge success for them. So, and I think in time, with more and more competition, as more and more casinos are authorized and built in the Northeast, you know, the pressure to diversify, it gets greater and greater all the time.
Well, we'll look for your coverage of the casinos in the day and on theday.com.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Would you even believe me when I say there was a point when Ted Nugent was interesting?
Leave Work Now with Rick Koster. Find us on theday.com or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
I saw that tour. It is without question the loudest thing I have ever heard in my life. My mom, she thought I was on acid when I came home because I couldn't answer any of her questions. I literally believe I suffered hearing damage permanently that night.